This episode of How to Save the World is sponsored by All Heart NZ, a registered charity dedicated to reducing, reusing, and redirecting corporate waste to help both the planet and Kiwi communities in need. Learn more about the amazing work they do at allheartnz.org.nz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of How to Save the World. My name is Tim Batt.
I'm Waveney Worth.
And we are joined by a pretty incredible guest today, a person who is a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit, one of the world's greatest ever multi-sports athletes, a Kiwi endurance sports icon, an author, an inventor, a world record holder, and an international motivational speaker who we have been very lucky to grab a little bit of time with. Steve Gurney's here. Steve Gurney, woo!
My farts do smell, though. I am basically human. Don't get my ego too big, eh?
Very Kiwi response to that introduction. Mm. But it's all true, you know?
No, you're sensationalising it. Actually, I've had to do a bit of navel-gazing since I retired from sport, and you realise that actually, what is success? We're measuring it in a Western way, you know, and perhaps I'm not all that successful.
I've seen you touch on this a couple of times, actually, in some chats. This is interesting. So you retired in 2007 off the back of an ankle injury, I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
And so where have you gone mentally and sort of philosophically
after that? I've been down a very deep, dark hole.
Tell me about it. What's been
happening? Well, actually, it's pretty topical because it is mental health awareness sort of, it's not week only, it's about the last few years.
Which dates when we're recording this, because this episode will come out a little bit later on, but... Yes, right now as we're speaking, it's Mental Health Awareness Week.
Yeah, so people are being encouraged to be more honest about what's going on in their heart and soul and mental space.
Because we all just look up to each other and think that everybody else has got it sorted. And
yeah, and Facebook doesn't help either when people only paste their A game, you know, you don't see the whole thing. So, I've written a book, I've written three books, but one of those books is a pretty blunt explanation of what happened after that retirement you talk about, and how I got really badly depressed, suicidally so, and so I spilled out my story as we're encouraging others to do as well. And basically, you know, I thought I was on the ladder to success, but it was just a hamster wheel, you know, just stepped off it 20 years later and I'm still in the same bloody spot, you know, trying to prove something that I am good enough. And to put it in a nutshell, you know, my general belief is that the human condition is that somewhere along our childhood, we learn that we're not lovable or not good enough or some variation on that theme. And we spend most of our life trying to fix it.
Absolutely.
And that's what my racing was all about, trying to fix it. And, you know, it didn't. You know, winning races is just like, as Eckhart Tolle, you know, the Power of Now author, tells us that, you know, we're looking for that time in the future once that we'll be happy. But the trick is that, you know, the future doesn't really come. The trick is to be happy now and do what you can in this moment.
And so it sounds like, just based on the fact that you refer to the Western way of looking at things, is how you used to have that perspective, that you've gone away a little bit from that now, or maybe you have a more holistic view of what success can look like.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, as they grow older, you know, we get a bit more retrospective and a bit wiser, I think, about what really matters in life, you know. And we're becoming to, you know, a lot of research now is coming out saying that social connection, you know, look, is I mean, a lot of loneliness is rife in older people, and I'm certainly starting to see that. And social connection, those sorts of things, are more a measure of success than what you've got in the bank or what car you're driving.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because within the context of our podcast about sustainability and the environment, there's a lot of intersects with that. And we've spoken to, well, a couple of activists really already. Sophie Hanford we had on recently, who was one of the national organisers for the School Strikes for Climate, and Robin Malcolm as well, who's had sort of a lifetime of advocacy and protesting and doing all of that good stuff. And there is a real social component of collective action and coming together to try and change something and improve practices. And so it seems like that stuff is, you know, feeding in at the moment, especially with climate change stuff. People are coming together to coalesce. And actually, something I was interested to ask you about, Steve, specifically, seeing as how we're talking a little bit about mental health, is you have spoken a bit about how you had nerves, especially early on in your career, and had to figure out how to sort of perform with those or solve it, and the anxiety that you get performing at such a high international level. And there's a phenomenon at the moment where a lot of people are being quite paralyzed by all of the dire information that's coming out about climate change. And I wonder if you had any sort of advice or methods that you've taught yourself about how to almost like weaponize the anxiety, or how we can keep functioning in spite of some people right now feeling very overwhelmed.
Good question. Oh my God, this is a good podcast.
Yeah, it was straight in there.
Yeah, in the deep end.
Because I just also wanted to add to that. It's like, to me, it feels like when people are talking about their mental health issues, to then throw in that extra layer of like, oh, we're all going to hell in a handbasket too.
Yeah.
It's like, and that's the context of the conversation for so many people.
Yeah. Well, rule number one that applies to all of this, to anything, I believe, is take a deep breath. Our grandmothers were right when she said count to 10 before you say anything. But the
doesn't
the
make for a good podcast though.
9, 8, 7. No, well, the point of that really is, the point I'm trying to make is to be present, you know, and to actually see the situation without judgment, without being wrong or right. Just step back and get a perspective on what's happening here. And so with respect to nerves. Okay, so I've learned to step back and observe without judgment, without saying, Steve, you're stupid, or any judgment like that. Just say, well, that's interesting. What's the purpose of the nerves? What are they trying to teach me? Or what's that part of me wanting to say? And then you realize that the nerves are just there trying to warn you of some danger that you've imagined, or that part of you has imagined might exist based on past experience. And then, so then from there, you can then take some concrete steps and figure out how to solve that. So for me, for example, racing, I feel the nerves. Well, what I can do is it's imagining all the things that might cause me to fail at my goal, a bike crash or, you know, things going wrong. And so I can then plan for that, how to prevent it. But I might have to get some more skills. So, you know, might be have to get better at kayaking down a rough river. And then once you've planned for it, you can also, I mean, that's the fence at the top of the cliff. You know, you can also do a few things about the ambulance at the bottom. You know, if I do get a hole in my kayak, make sure I've got a roll of duct tape and a method of drying the boat, that sort of stuff. So it's about being that, listening to that part of you who's making you nervous, and then taking action from that so it can reduce your nervousness. It's also important to thank that part of you. Say, look, thanks, you know, I really appreciate that you're running actually on an old program from childhood. I've got a better program now, thanks. So there's this another saying that says, what you resist persists. So if you try and push it away and say ignore that part of you that's trying to give you the warning, it will just hang about. So you've got to actually take it on. And it's a bit like seaweed, you know, that long kelp seaweed. When a wave comes in at the cliff face there, and there's, you see the wave smash onto the rocks and causes a huge energy explosion of waves and water. By contrast, there's those long tendrils of kelp on a rock just a few meters out further. The wave comes, the kelp moves with the wave silently, calmly. The wave passes and the kelp moves back again to where it was. So that's the kelp is accepting the situation, dealing with it and let it pass, whereas the rock is saying no, and boom. So that's another thing to do with nerves, is to accept that the nerves are a part of being human, deal with it and move on.
You got to move with things a little bit.
And yes. I do like that as a broader analogy for our ecological situation too. It's like, because it is something that is a pretty dark feeling that just layers on to other dark feelings that we can have, and to just, if we can cultivate that attitude.
Yep.
Of actually just not putting a judgment on it.
Yeah.
And not sort of.
Weirdly, I've seen some interviews with Bill Hader, the comedian, who's like an SNL longtime alumni. And he talks about how to this day he still struggles with anxiety, but he was absolutely riddled with nerves, like would vomit every time he was going to do an appearance on SNL. And he's one of the greats. Like, he's considered one of the best in the last 20 years SNL players. Saturday Night Live, sorry, for those outside the comedy community. And he said a very similar thing to you, Steve, in terms of the real turnkey moment for him was going, this is a thing that's happening. I need to not ignore it. I need to acknowledge that it's there. And he talks about sort of making friends with it. He goes, he talks about it like it's on his shoulder. He goes, oh, you're back. Oh, hi. Good to see you again. Okay. I'm listening to you. That's fine. So I've got to go and do this thing now, but I know that you're there, and that's okay. So
and another part of that is to acknowledge, it's a reframe, to say, well, actually, the fact that I'm feeling nervous means this is really important. If I was feeling nonchalant and didn't care, then I'm not spending my life doing things that matter. And so it's a matter of congratulating yourself for taking on stuff that's outside your comfort zone.
I like that.
That's a good reframe. And so do you think that sort of goes a long way to getting out of that paralysis cycle?
Absolutely, in taking action, yeah. There's another thing you can do. I mean, there's other stuff, like there's an NLP process called anchoring. Well,
NLP, neuro-linguistical programming.
Yeah, neuro-linguistic program, yeah. So it sounds fancy, but it's just understanding what do people do in their heads and in terms of what they say to themselves, what they imagine and those sorts of things, and working with that to make it more useful. So an NLP process called anchoring, actually there's many other modalities that use anchoring, and we do it naturally. Like when I say to you, popcorn, what comes to mind?
A microwave for some reason.
or the circus or the movie theater or something. That's anchoring. Yeah. The smell of popcorn is anchored in your brain as an experience you've had. So it's just doing that on purpose. So with the nerves, you can have an anchor for calmness. So you imagine the times that you've been calm and relaxed and powerful, and anchor that to a physical gesture you do, and then anchor or actuate that physical gesture when you're feeling nervous. And that reminds you to be nervous, to be calm and powerful. Yeah.
There's so many people I'm talking to who are my age in their early 30s who are like genuinely getting slightly riddled with anxiety about the climate and the environment. And I think one thing that you have said, and I've heard this from other people, even on this podcast, is taking action is so important. And
I picked that up too.
It's not about attempting to solve climate change by yourself.
No.
But there's something very powerful about taking some small little action, some sort of change. It could be connecting with a group that is focused on these issues and just starting that communication. It could be initiating a conversation with friends and talking about it.
Yeah, all the little things you do around the house.
Could be going to a march. It could be start composting. It could be, decide that on Mondays you're not going to eat red meat. But there's something very powerful about taking it into your own hands, even in a small way, making a change, I think.
Yeah, I did a couple of small things a couple of weeks ago. It's just like positioning the recycling bin into a more handy place. So I use it. My flatmates would use it more instead of chucking stuff in the rubbish. Pulling out the window.
I'm interested to pick your brains because you're very psychological with this stuff. You've got like the engineer and the psychology thing is coming through.
Oh, yeah.
You were saying you're also just building a house and purposefully not putting in a space for a dryer.
Yeah, well, and make a really easy-to-use clothesline. So you can dry stuff out.
And this is Queenstown, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So most people would think that they needed a dryer. That's quite hardcore.
Yeah, well, I put the clothesline is just a piece of rope on two pulleys, but it's under the eaves so that no matter if it's raining, your clothes are still getting dry. So and making it accessible so your flatmates or your family members or whoever is living in your space will feel it's just as easy to use that as the dryer, if not easier and more satisfying, you know. So
just removing those barriers, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's removing doing just the things you want
to do. Little steps. It can be so overwhelming. Like we were talking, waving and I.
We tried not to, didn't we? Yeah. We're having great conversation in the car.
We're gonna save it. Keep it on the microphone. Thank you very much.
But we were talking about booking air flights. You know how hypocritical it feels, and when I'm booking my flights, I just tend to quickly gloss over, like a ostrich who's put his head in the sand. You know, gloss over the carbon.
Do you think about that stuff, Steve?
Oh, I do. It's really getting, on my conscience, but. There's nothing I can do about it that right this moment. I feel like I'm a bit powerless to do anything about it at the moment, apart from book less flights. But
an offset.
But my conscience. Well, I'm not in that space yet, but I'm slowly getting there by doing other little things. You know, becoming more and more conscious by doing things like planting the garden last week. You know, pulling out the winter stuff and putting in the veggie gardens.
Are you a big gardener?
No, I find it really hard, but. A couple of years ago, I said, right, there's a really nice sunny spot. I'm going to build a couple of garden beds. And it was pretty easy, actually. Pretty nice whacking a couple of waratahs and some macrocarpa boards and getting some horse poo from down the road and making a garden. I found it really, really, really satisfying. And then to see these little seedlings grow and eventually eating stuff that was, you know, half an hour was growing in the garden, I'm now eating it. That's pretty damn satisfying. And that's just a little step. And it's so nice pulling out the weeds. I didn't realize it would be so nice, you know. But it's something you got to do a little step at a time. And it can be often be overwhelming to think, sure, I've got to plant a garden. Where shall I start? Well, just do a little bit at a time and eventually get there. And now I'm an avid fan of gardening. It feels so good to have your fingers buried in the dirt. And there is a concept called earthing, isn't there, that you're actually getting rid of static charge by digging yourself into the
Yeah, it turns out there's quite a few health benefits, like the microbes as well in the soil. Yeah. And it's why little kids eat dirt. Apparently, they actually, it's good for their gut and all of that.
We're not dietitians. Don't feed your kids dirt and then go, Waveney on this podcast told me.
Yeah, don't sue me.
Well, eating dirt actually refers to crashing off your bike, doesn't it? Not actually eating dirt.
Yeah, true that. Yeah. We probably should have led with this, Steve, considering our podcast is about sort of the environment and sustainability. But tell us, like, where are you at with these sorts of things? I mean, you're an athlete, you're a motivational speaker, you write books. What is your thinking about these sorts of issues? Where are you philosophically and mentally with these things?
Yeah, it says that it's something that the environment's something you really strongly care about.
Of course, I mean, you know, since day dot, I've always been encouraged by my folks to get out and play outside, and
you did. You took that to heart, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, and then I was in the boys' brigade as a boy. You know, we go out tramping a lot, and I've really developed an absolute love and joy of being in the wilderness, out in the either on a mountaintop or actually just in the bush, just hiking a normal old track with good old New Zealand bush. The smells of the ferns and the dirt, and oh, it's just so rejuvenating. So I have a very close affinity with being connected with nature and disconnected from the other connectedness of social media and that sort of crap. So so I've always been interested in creating greater accessibility for other people that, you know, I'm a role model to, encourage them to get out doing physical exercise in nature, not around at a stadium or a gym. But there's other things, like when I lived in Christchurch, I was one of the instigators to get the sewage discharge out of the estuary. Ideally, we would have no sewage discharge, but at least it's better to have it in the ocean than into the estuary where there's kayakers and swimmers and shellfish gatherers and yachties and stuff like that and kids playing. So, you know, we do our bit where we can. And does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm actually interested to hear more about the estuary stuff that you're involved with. So what's the story there?
Oh, I mean, it's historical. It was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But, you know, I lived in Christchurch on the edge of the estuary. I used to use that as my training ground for coast-to-coast training.
When you're sort of heading out towards Sumner?
Yes, that's right. So the Avon Rivers and the Heathcote Rivers flow into an estuary, which then flows out into the ocean at Sumner Beach. And so there's a lot of recreation. There's three yacht clubs. There's people gathering shellfish all the time. There's, in summer, there's kids and me swimming. There's kayakers. There's
the shags. The birds, I stress. There's a beautiful big rock called Shag
swimming
Rock.
Steve and the shags.
I think in the earthquake it fell down.
It's Shag Pile now, yes.
Right.
Or it's Shagged Rock.
So what were they doing? Like, what was happening before? Who was it, the council had a waste discharge going out there?
Yeah, it's historically been a sewage treatment ponds in Bromley, and my memory's a bit fuzzy on how it exactly was, but something like this. So it kept growing as Christchurch population grew, and so they needed to keep expanding it, and they wanted to expand it again, and finally a few of us said, no, not enough's enough, you know, we need to do something about this. Let's get rid of sewage if we can by, you know, encouraging reducing the production of sewage. Like, can we do composting toilets and those sorts of things, and industrial waste? Let's look at that and see if we can do more recycling there.
Were you actually seeing firsthand the estuary change? Like, I'm assuming you were out there on the water.
Oh yeah, no, I kayak right by it. There's, as the tide goes out of the estuary, they open the gates and all this poop on waste goes into the estuary. So
you're seeing it.
Yeah, actually seeing it, and we feared falling out of our kayaks in that area, and there's a yacht club right next to it. It was crazy. I mean, in the early days, when Christchurch was smaller, it probably wasn't a problem, but as the population grew, we didn't keep up.
That's one of the things Kate Meads talked about when she was on the show with us, that it's we have a perception that the waterworks, the sewage treatment plants, kind of magically deal with all this crap that we put down the drain. And actually, they're quite good at taking the solids out. But really, if it's heavy metals or the bleaches, like anything, paint, plastic, you know, paint is plastic, anything like that, all they can do is really just dilute it.
And so what's happening, it's slowly crept as technology and our knowledge of chemicals and heavy metals and what have you, not just our knowledge, our use of it, it's creeping, it's a slow creep, isn't it? You know, in the early days, perhaps we didn't have so much toxic waste. Mm. Now, there's more and more.
It is a slow creep.
And we've done nothing about, we're a bit slow, we'll lag behind, you know, what we can do about reducing and recycling and preventing.
So what did you do? So the estuary is slowly filling up with poo. You were nervous about falling into basically a bio-waste hazard.
Well, yeah, it's not just poo. Zone. It's as Waverley said, it's the all the other nasties that come with it. So there's a big argument. The mayor said at the time, he said, oh, no, you can drink this stuff. It's the output, you know, it's so clean. So
you go first. So
there you go.
We got a protest. We got a whole lot of like-minded people together. We got together. We converged on the estuary causeway and we collected a jar of the output water and challenged the mayor to drink it. And he claimed that it was. And that was kind of the turning point. We said, okay, let's do something about this. And so we said, you know, ideally we'd rather the whole thing was cleaned up, but that wasn't going to be an option. So we said, well, let's discharge it out to sea where there's no recreation, at least, until we can do some more about it. So that's what happened. And
I remember that pipe. Yeah. I was living in Christchurch at the time. Yeah, I remember
There's Dora the Borer, but there's a machine that dug underground and put the pipeline out to sea. So it's not the ideal solution, but it's better than humans getting poisoned and sick. And some people got terrible skin problems and that sort of stuff.
But you mentioned as well that in tandem with that, you were sort of looking at other waste reduction techniques as well.
Yeah, well, that kind of opened my mind to think, well, actually, let's be more answerable to what we're doing to the environment. If we want to use all these chemicals and have a consumerism lifestyle, we'd have to take more personal responsibility for the waste we put, you know, that we create. And as Waverley said, you know, so many people just think, okay, out of mind, they push the button on the toilet and they've poured something down there, or they flush something down the kitchen sink or the tub, and they think that's the end of it, but it's not.
To be fair, we would just geared up to think that. Like, nobody is ever, saying, like, there's no warnings on products. I think it's fair enough to assume that if it's okay to buy it, then it must be okay. Like, why on earth are we selling this stuff that actually harms our waterways and
kills our fish? That's such a psychological thing, isn't it? Because I think we assume there's some authoritative body that's given it a tick or an okay.
Yeah, and there
isn't.
But it's like, just
there's no mechanism to stop it being sold, basically.
There's quite strong stuff around if we're swallowing it, but apart from that.
Yeah. One solution is to, as part of the school curriculum, we get taken through the waste treatment plant and explain where it all goes. Mm. Follow the pipeline from our home drains out to this treatment plant to the environment. And it's just a matter of awareness, really. It's just because as a kid, I never really envisaged it. We never were told. It was never.
And like you say, slow creep. I quite like that because it's a very forgiving statement, really. It's not like we all intentionally went out to create the situation, but we've ended up on it.
I mean, I'm horrified. I remember my first car I bought as a teenager, you know, and I changed the oil and some oil went down the drain. I didn't even think about it until a couple of years later. I clicked, my light bulb went on. I thought, shit, where did that oil actually go? And I realised.
I've been painting for years, like houses or whatever, and just washing up and just not thinking about where the paint goes. Now I'm living rurally, and all of the systems we've got there is no away. Like, they either go into our septic tank or they go into a disposal field or, you know, into a stream or whatever we do. There is literally no place that I can put a toxic.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm painting, I'm thinking, what do I do with the paint?
What do you do with it?
Well, I
put it on the wall.
Yeah, exactly. try and minimize it as much as I can. Yeah, I realized that I didn't want it to go down any drain. And so it was just one paintbrush I had to clean. And so I took it right into the middle of our driveway, gravel drive. And I just picked the point that was going to be the most absorbent, the most isolated from any waterways, and thought, well, you know, at least that's giving it a decent chance.
Everyone should do like a month of living like that, yeah, away from the connected
it
systems.
Was, you know, despite all of this rubbish-free stuff that I do, it was just that point when I realised for paint and all the stuff that goes down the drain when I suddenly had to deal with it myself.
And that's a good point. Yeah. I think we need to... the only way to change people's opinions really is to get to their values. You know, how does this affect their personal values? And that's one way is... I mean, another example of that is I've got some friends who went on a year of sailing with their two kids. And on a yacht, you have to be so conservative of hot water and fresh water and food you've got because there's a limit, you know. And they came back and I think they were off living with some, stayed with some friends for a week, and their friends were amazed how thoughtful these kids were at reducing their consumption of stuff.
Quick showers. And
yeah, exactly the point, because they've been forced to go in one of those situations like Waverley, living rurally. And I think that might be one of the really good answers is maybe camps for school kids, I don't know.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff where they actually have to go and live that lifestyle for a week or
it is month. It is our affluence, I think. We were saying about that too, weren't we? How it's all very well buying organic or being vegan or whatever, but it's actually the money we've got that we're able to spend that increases our carbon footprint probably beyond people who aren't making those choices.
This episode of How to Save the World is sponsored by All Heart NZ, the charitable trust helping Kiwi corporates be more responsible with their stuff.
All Heart NZ are providing tools and expert advice to support businesses to improve their sustainability and social good, and not just in New Zealand.
By providing expert support services and tech solutions, they're helping tackle huge international problems like modern slavery embedded in global supply chains. Thank goodness for All Heart NZ. You can learn more at allheartnz.org.nz.
You mentioned, so with the Eastery episode that you had, and you actually said, were you part of forming a trust or something that sort of sorted that out?
Oh, it was the Ihutai Trust, which is already existing, but I think we're working. I mean, as I say, my memory's a bit foggy on how it exactly was, but that we were working in tandem, yeah.
Well, the question I had was, there was obviously a time when you saw like a distinct change. Because you do a lot of globetrotting and you have for many years, do you feel like you've seen the effects of climate change firsthand at all as you've been travelling around?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's the obvious ones of pollution. You know, like when I'm going to some of these Asian countries for races, just the amount of plastic you see on the beaches is just so sad. Yeah, it's all these bottles and shit washed up. But we did a kite buggy trip across the Sahara Desert. So we're really proud of this. Actually, we used wind power only for four of us to cross the Sahara Desert. It took us a month, 2,500 kilometres, using just kites.
And that's one of your world records, isn't it?
The record for distance has since been broken for kite travel, but I think we're the first we know of to cross the Sahara Desert by kites.
Amazing.
And so we did a lot of that down the coastline, and I was just tears to my eyes, the amount of dead stuff down that coast. Dead fish, dead animals, washed up dead dolphins. But then,
really,
and a lot of it though is the amount of junk and plastic and human product byproduct that was washed up on the beach, causing such destruction. And yeah, I don't know how to describe the sorrow I feel from that. That's probably the most impactful observation I've had is the coast of the Sahara Desert.
And that was where a lot of your motivation has come from.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just the coast either, but can I add to that? You know, some of the towns we went inland to get supplies, to get to the town from out in the desert, you have to pass through some wasteland, so to speak. And you'd see where people were just driven out and dumped rubbish in the desert for it to blow all over the show. And there's just stuff everywhere, and what you thought might be a pristine kind of desert is actually not.
Because, you know, I imagine it really pristine.
There's junk.
That's
everywhere.
What David Attenborough has been saying about having to get the shots for his documentaries closer and closer to, because the wide shots are just picking up the rubbish or the destruction. Wow. Or these so-called pristine places are actually having to be really carefully framed.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And there's another trip I did. Mount Rinjani is in Lombok, Indonesia. And the government there asked me to go and investigate the possibility of a running race up this mountain. It's the highest mountain on that piece of land, and it's a national park. And I thought, oh yeah, this is cool. So I thought I'd run it in a day, see if it's feasible. And there was not one spot you could stop on that track and not see a bit of litter. And this is a national park.
Man.
And I mean, most of the time you'd see, you know, at 1 meter intervals, there's all sorts of plastic wrappers and stuff, you know, that trampers and runners and hikers dump.
Just drop.
Yeah, and so where I guess I'm trying not to be judgmental here, but we're reasonably developed, you know, Western country, and Indonesia and those, you know, Sahara Desert countries, they're South African countries are not as developed as us. So it's going to take a long time for the education side of things to catch up. Meanwhile, our natural world, wilderness is just being further and further degraded by us being
human.
And you know, and then you get to the bigger question. I get a bit overwhelmed at this stage. I think, well, the answer is to stop producing humans at this stage.
Is that where you're sitting at the moment?
The planet's full.
I don't believe that myself. I don't subscribe to that.
Well, okay, it's full until we stop abusing it like we do.
I hear you. I think that's right. I think the systems need to change.
Yeah.
This is kind of one of the biggest, I think, questions of our time at the moment. Because I think there's a lot of people, particularly, you know, really staunch activists in the environmental movement who do sort of subscribe to that belief that it's like, nah, no more kids. We're all done here. But I've been having a lot of chats recently. I actually had a good chat to my wife last night over dinner about this. I've just got an unshakable belief.
Are you planning 10 kids, by the way?
Absolutely not. I'm one of four and I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
Anyway, you've got this unshakable belief, sorry.
I've got an unshakable belief in humans' ability to change things. And obviously it goes both ways. But the fact of the matter is, we invented plastic not 100 years ago. And we've already, because it was such an effective product, managed to proliferate it to the point where it has killed a whole, like, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of species. You know, a lot of marine life is getting wiped out. But if you kind of take away the negative connotation from it and just look at the power that we have, we went plastic rules, we're going to make an absolute truckload of it, and we did. And I think if we are able to do some of the things you're talking about, appeal to people's values, get real on the science, manage to convince people without paralyzing them with the sort of dire real situation that we're in, our ability to change things is astronomical. And that's why I don't buy into the thing of no more humans, because we just have an amazing capacity to make things and invent things and create things and change situations.
We also have that same capacity to absolutely screw things.
And we've proved that pretty resoundingly at the moment.
We're consumers who are just basically driven by selfish desire to have things for ourselves.
We're very good to sort of pseudo philosophical territory now, but yeah. I believe in people. Yeah. And I think that there's a thing that's going on at the moment where people are being confused for their governments. I think that, you know, it's very easy for the international community to look at places like America or even like Bolsonaro in Brazil, who seems by all accounts to be a massive asshole and like a climate change denier, and he's burning half the Amazon down for a quick buck, you know, in the short term. And these powerful guys who are leading these countries at the moment, I don't think they're actually very reflective of the population. I think if you talk to people around the globe, average, you know, normal citizens of the countries, they actually really care. Like this will obviously date exactly when we've taped this, but we had the school strike for climate change today.
Yeah.
So I was just at that before I came to this record. And apparently, they said on the loudspeaker, this might get updated, but they said there was 80,000 people there. And I was like overwhelmed with the amount of people there. And just the feeling that it was like ordinary, everyday people give a shit at the moment in a big way. And it's people like Greta Thunberg at the moment who are becoming these lightning rods for change. And it does feel like we're making progress. Obviously, it needs to be happening quite a bit faster than what we're doing at the moment.
But yeah, there
seeing
is
the
that,
young people
yeah.
out there and the passion behind it and their dedication, it was like super inspiring.
It's interesting, guys, because I think you're both bringing up two like really valid sides of like an age-old argument.
Which way, you know, yes.
are we essentially good or not? And I think you're both right in terms of we could easily have more people on the planet if we were living in a completely different way. Apparently our biomass, like the weight of humankind, is roughly about the same as ants. So it's there's the ants are fine, and it's really the solutions we've got to things turning out to be, you know, there's some unintended consequences to those solutions, so we need some new ones. What we do have as well is when we talk about humans, how much of that is just our Western worldview, because we actually have hundreds, maybe thousands of examples of indigenous cultures around the world who have lived in a smaller version of what we're going through now, where their whole world hit a limit, like say New Zealand would be a great example of that, Aotearoa, and it got to a point where people, like say Easter Island, they made some choices, they made some different choices, and they hit their limits and things collapsed. And then there's literally thousands of examples of humans, not other, but us as humankind, who have made quite different decisions and gone, you know, look at before Pākehā arrived in New Zealand, Māori had gone through a transition of understanding, like, this is finite. We've just gone through all the moa. This, you know, we can't carry on like this. And they're on an island. It's already really intensive. Like, they're actually running out of food, if you think about it. They've just gone through all their big game. And so they've got less food. They've got more population. And they are able to say the sorts of things that we can say now. It's like, well, if I don't take it, that other tribe's just going to take it. If I don't feed my family, then they're going to grow bigger. And and it's just exactly the same sort of logic. But they did it. Mm. Like, they actually did it in a situation that's, if not more life and death than ours. And they all somehow, all these different iwi, managed to agree on a new set of principles.
Yeah, the cultural mechanisms that were used are really interesting. Like, you know, declaring an area to be tapu, which has sort of a spiritual component. But in some respects, another way of looking at it is like, well, if we overfish it, there's going to be nothing left here. So we're going to kind of say, this is a no-go zone. And
that's
it's kind
right.
of
and
the
they...
same as being like a protected, what we would consider like a protected area or...
And they managed it, like competing tribes managed it, and that's not the only example. Like, we've like this whole Western phenomena, like, yes, it's the most powerful force we have on the planet, but it is also an anomaly in terms of our human condition.
Yeah, so the Easter Island one's a good one, an example. You know, someone chopped down the last tree, knowing it was the last tree. What was going through their head? And, well, there is another author, Ronald Wright, who has written a book, The Short History of Progress, and he uses the analogy, do humans listen from the black boxes of crashed civilizations previous to us? And Easter Island is one of his examples. The Sumerians is another. The Mayans is another one. And I mean, he opines that humans, by nature, don't really listen to failures of generations before them or civilizations before them. It's just we're just motivated by what's in it for us.
So here, to take a step back from all this stuff, what I would love to pick your brain about for a bit, Steve, is goal setting stuff. So within the context of we've got a few problems, we've got a few issues at the moment, we've got big climate changey ones, and then we've got smaller sort of environmental ones. You're talking about the rubbish that's strewn around in particular environments. If we want to make some changes, what are some good goal setting techniques and ways of changing behavior and actually like getting shit done that you think are effective?
Yeah,
how
good
do you
question.
Approach these things?
This is an age old question, really. So my approach now, you know, the further I get down the track, the more I realize goal setting is only successful, or you're only successful at getting your goals if they are aligned with your values or your purpose on the planet. So if your goal you set supports your purpose for being alive, or your purpose that you think of what you're here on this planet for, then you'll go through anything to achieve that goal. So I think that's the key, is get intrinsic here, not extrinsic, not, you know, ass-kicking methods. It's about how do you appeal to someone from their heart.
Would you say if there's a person who is very anxious about the environmental stuff, do you think that suggests they do have a value that's geared towards they want to?
Oh, absolutely. Anxiety or nervous, yeah, that sort of, you know, that emotional response means it really matters to them, of course. And so I think that's the way to do it, is to figure out if we're going to set goals, let's make sure that they're articulated or designed in a way that people can hook into that what's in it for me sort of thing, you know, with them. You know, if it supports what's what people really care about or what they really want, then they'll be right behind it.
If someone wants to get something done or change behaviour in their own life, like, have you got any hot tips on how to get that
done? I've heard you speak, Steve, just put some words in your mouth, about when you've done some long enduro races, the amount of time and energy you put into just like carving off the end of a zipper and stuff like that. And
I've heard people talk about this with you as
Yeah,
well.
It's pretty legendary.
Well, okay, where do I start? I
can talk for like because 5 hours on this. What we'd like you to do is apply this to climate change.
Right, okay, so one, I've talked already about...
He's lost it. He's totally
I'm
lost
overwhelmed.
It.
We really have thrown a lot at you.
I've just mentioned, of course, that you design the goal, you know, how does this support your purpose on the planet? So that's the first step. Then there's a whole lot of techniques and principles that follow on from that. But, you know, in terms of overwhelm, well, you don't get to the top of a mountain in one jump. You know, you take one step at a time. So let's pick the easy steps. And the first little step, you know, is what do you think is within your control that you can do to get you the first thing? What can you do in the next 5 minutes that'll get you started? The hardest part actually is just getting momentum up, just getting taking the first step. So referring to Waverley's, talk of me chopping off zipper pullers and the toothbrush handle. You know, this is how we start an adventure race. We accumulate all of our gear that we have to take in the race, and then we go about finding ways to lighten the load. You know, there's a saying that says if you want to travel far and fast, lose your baggage. So that's emotional baggage, but you can also apply that in a physical way. So we think, righto, we chop off a zipper puller because it's a metal thing. We replace it with a little tiny bit of string, so that saves, you know, a couple of grams. And
gosh, it's incredible.
And we do take a toothbrush on these races to stop ulcers forming in our mouths. But we don't take one each. We take one that we share amongst the team. Whoa. And we chop the handle off that, you know, so it's lighter. So just I'm giving you examples. The first aid kit, you know, it doesn't say in the rules that the tubes of ointment have to be full. So we squeeze half of it out and put that half in a Ziploc bag, and we throw away the tube container and half of it. So we end up, you get the idea, these tiny little things we do.
So what would it add up to? Like, are you saving a half a kilo?
Yeah, 800 grams per person on average.
It's supposed to be a metaphor, Waverley. You've gotten distracted by the mechanics.
You've just taken off another track.
I don't know if it's worthwhile.
No, well, 800 grams to 900 grams per person over a week, cumulatively, that's a lot of blisters, and you know, a lot of time saved or energy saved. But the point is, someone says to me, well, Steve, chopping off the zipper puller, that's not going to win you the race. And they're right, it won't win us the race. But the zipper puller plus the piece of webbing off the belt plus the toothbrush handle plus the tube out of the womb, it all adds up, and that's the cumulative.
Here's the gold.
It's all the little bits that add up. It's the accumulation of all those that gives us the advantage. And it's a psychological advantage. You know, we'd be lined up at the start of the race, you know, getting ready for on the start line 10 minutes before the start, and our packs are noticeably smaller and lighter than the USA team who's next to us lining up getting ready to start. And the USA guy looks across us at us and says, oh, Steve, I think you might have left some of that compulsory gear out of your pack. Are you cheating? And I say, no, mate. So I open my bag and show him, you know, I unzip it with a little piece of string instead of the metal tag. And you see his jaw slowly drop to the ground. And as I show him all the little things we've done, and then the gun goes, boom, and off we go. And imagine the psychology of the USA guys thinking, oh, shies, are we carrying, you know, 800 grams, cumulatively 2.5 kilograms more than we need to in this race, compared to what we've done, knowing we've gone through with a fine-tooth comb, optimizing our chances of winning this race to the highest level. And so there's a psychology there as well of knowing that I've gone out and planted my vegetables. You know, it was $10 from the vegetable, from the nursery to buy these seedlings. Knowing that I've just spent that 10 minutes planting the garden, it's only a small step, but it's add that to me shifting the recycling bin closer to the window so my flatmates will use it more often instead of putting stuff in the rubbish. Add this to the clothesline under the eaves. Add this to all these other little things you do, and you think, actually, I'm making quite a bit of a contribution to the planet.
That's awesome.
And once you've made that one little step of planting the seedling, I've actually got the ball rolling, and you think, I now feel energized enough to go and do those other little changes.
Fantastic.
And before you know it, you've got a way of life.
Yeah. And yeah.
So,
Yeah. So and then there's that power of the disassembled crowd, like you were talking about being at the climate change rally today, Tim, and that power, I guess, that you feel all together, and just the fact that you see the numbers and it's like, wow, there's X number of people here. Like, regardless of whether those people went to the rally today or not, they exist and they're all doing the same sort of stuff that Steve's talking about. And that's where the power is. It's a direction that we face, isn't it?
Exactly, direction we face,
I think that's a pretty good place for us to probably round off. Steve Gurney, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It has been a real privilege to have you here on the show and to get to hang out with you for an hour. So thank you for making the time.
Hey, and I'm inspired by the difference you guys are making to the planet. Thanks. Keep going. Communication's the way to go.
We're trying. Mm-hmm. We're trying. If people want to track you down online, Steve, what's the best way for them to do it and read your books?
SteveGurney.co.nz.
Easy. So easy.
Google.
Cool. Hey, if you enjoyed the show, please tell your mates. Chuck us a little review. 5 stars is very helpful to get other people to find out about the show. But otherwise, Waveney and I will catch you on the next episode. Until then,
bye.
Thanks again to our sponsor, All Heart NZ, who are improving the planet and the lives of Kiwis through reducing, reusing, and redirecting corporate waste. Check them out at allheartnz.org.nz.